Commentary Track. Conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 71 of the Commentary Track, and they said it wouldn't last. This has been a hectic week, lots of stuff going on, and I'm a day late in getting this out, but I needed to get it out because it's a lot about CineCon, and CineCon is this weekend, Labor Day weekend. So my guest is Vice President of CineCon, Stan Taffel. Stan is a very knowledgeable film guy, a big collector, knows a lot about the history of silent film especially, and, well, film in general. And I see the guy all the time. Yeah, I'll tell you all about that later. But we've never actually sat down before the microphones until this. And I had a great time talking movies with Stan. And we'll talk a little bit about what's coming up at CineCon. And I hope that you'll join us there. So since this is kind of a long one, I'm going to make this part short. Enjoy my talk with Stan Taffel. When did you start getting interested in films that were beyond your own lifetime?
This is a really good question.
Why, thank you.
And I know the absolute moment, which is really rare, and I've talked about it with my family and friends. I was very, very little, and I mean single digits, and my father was running home movies that were taken when I was a baby. And I was hardly in them, but there were other people in the movies, and one guy in particular was so funny. He is the typical home movie person you've seen in someone's home movies that begins to box with the movie camera and just has a conversation you cannot understand, and he's having this wonderful life. And I was laughing. I remember distinctly laughing out loud. And I asked my dad who he was. And he said, oh, you know, he was an uncle of mine when I was growing up. My dad lost his dad when he was 4 years old, so this was one of the guys that watched my dad grow up. And I said to him, I want to meet him. And he said to me, well, you can't. He died a long time ago. And that was when I instantly realized the power and the importance of preservation and film in general. It was that moment. I have that movie in our family collection. And it's been a long time since I've seen it, but when I see it, I remember that absolute moment in Technicolor. It's like it was just yesterday. And that's what made me realize there's other stuff out there that I have to find. And then as a result, watching a guy in black and white film on public television who was being absolutely ridiculous, being funny, smacking into things, throwing things, hitting things, flirting with the girls. He had a derby hat on. He had this Adolf Hitler mustache, and he wore this interesting outfit that didn't fit him, and he had a bamboo cane. And I had no idea how old the film was. I just thought, this is the funniest man I've ever seen on television. And, of course, after realizing who he was and how long ago the films were made, I just started to collect the films. You'd go to the old department stores. In New York, we had Mays, we had Masters, S. Klein, and they would have Castle Film displays and Atlas Film displays. And the very first film that I ever owned that was Chaplin was a little 50-foot reel, which was, interestingly enough, called The Immigrant. And it really was from that film, because Atlas Films would retitle and rename these films. And I would run that over and over, much to the dismay of my father. And then they started letting me buy other films.
What scene did they pick for The Immigrant?
They picked the scene in the restaurant where Chaplin was eating the beans, meeting Edna, and then there was a hard cut where he was realizing that he had no money to pay, and he watches the other man in the restaurant, played by John Rand, get beat up by Eric Campbell.
Yeah.
So that's the sequence, and I don't care if I see it from the nitrate camera negative. I still have that little 50-foot roll because that means the world to me.
Sure.
That was what started my love for Chaplin on film and collecting.
Now, Chaplin has remained your favorite movie-related person of any kind, right?
For me, Chaplin is the guy who, while the beginnings of motion pictures were playing checkers. For me, Chaplin was inventing Pac-Man. He's, for me, the source from where everything flows.
Yeah. I was writing for American Film a long time ago and was writing about Chaplin for some reason. And I remember writing, Chaplin is the mountain of film history. You have to go over him or around him, but you can't ignore him. You know, he's like the basis of almost everything.
That's brilliant. Yes.
Pretty brilliant.
It is brilliant, Frank. Yes, these people who listen to you, they know what a great writer you are. They've read your books. And that is beautiful. You can't go around him. Wow, I like that.
Now, when did you start collecting films as a hobby?
In 1967, the first film I ever owned, and it wasn't the Chaplin film, that was my first silent film, but my first film was House of Frankenstein, the 8mm 200-foot Castle films, and I amassed a tremendously large collection of Castle films and Atlas films and Carnival films, eventually Black Hawk films. It overtook every square inch of my room, and eventually when I had a place of my own, I had film everywhere, and I can't describe it to people who are young in the 21st century, who find it so conveniently easy to pop a DVD or stream something. There is something tangible about wanting to have these films. I can certainly watch gorgeous, pristine footage on DCP, on the very latest technology, but, you know, I will still run a 16mm print of City Lights over anything else, because that's my favorite film. I like the sound of the projector. I like hearing the film, and sometimes there are splices and bad sprockets, and you hear the projector react with the precise sound for what's running through it. And I can't get over it. My wife has begged me to glean the field, so to speak, and take things away, which occasionally I will. I won't buy modern films in 16mm that were shot digitally or that are in stereo, so I have condescended to the fact that I will not just collect anything. But if you show me a collection of 16mm Hal Roach two-reelers that are print-downs from 35, I will take that over any digital copy every single time.
There's something also about the pursuit of this stuff that I think was important in at least getting my own enthusiasm going, because the fact that it wasn't easy, the fact that it wasn't right at your fingertips all the time, you really had to work to see this stuff. When I was first looking, well, I didn't really start looking at silent film until around 1970 or so, 69 or 70, and there was just no way to get it. And so you really had to work. If you had, you know, you had to save up money to buy a Black Hawk print or, and then when I got to Boston, I would sometimes find myself just driving, or not driving, I didn't have a car, but just having to travel great distances just to see something. And I think that also makes it, you know, just part of the collecting thing makes it more dear to us than just being able to, you know, hey, have you ever seen Citizen Kane? Oh, yeah, just pop it up on the computer. Bang, there it is. But the first time I saw it, I had to work to see it. I really had to go someplace to see it, you know?
You are right. Being a film collector, as opposed to an archivist, because eventually, if you're helping to preserve things, then you're an archivist. But as a collector, it's like a scavenger hunt. It really is. Finding films when I was a kid, aside from the Castle films you could buy in a store, was very difficult. There was a place in New York City, Willoughby Peerless, on 32nd Street, and I would take the train in the Long Island Railroad, and I would get out of Penn Station and walk straight up 32nd Street, and I would walk in there, and there were three guys, Bill, Lewis, and Joel. Wow, look at that. I haven't talked about them, but they're in my head. And they had a library, the Select Film Library, where they had 16mm films, and you could go and buy 16s there. And as you get older, you find there are other places. There was a man named Norman Levinson out in Long Island, the International Film Service, and he really opened up a tremendous array of doors for me. He had negatives I'd never held negatives in my hand, and he had printing negatives of films that he told me, what do you want, and I can get it printed. And back then it wasn't quite as expensive, but still, it was expensive to a 12-year-old
sure.
kid. And I would go there, and he would give me films to look at. He taught me how to thread 16-millimeter projectors. He really gave me so much information. Whenever I watch Cinema Paradiso, I always think of Norman Levinson, because in a weird way, my relationship with an older person who loved film was kind of like that.
Yeah.
I wasn't in a big projection booth, but he had a projection booth in his home, and that was the first one I ever saw, a projection booth in someone's home. I have to have that. And as a result, I converted our basement into a 12-seat movie theater, and I was, at that time, I wasn't even running 16 then. I was running standard 8mm prints of the Gold Rush and Son of the Sheik and Phantom of the Opera. Anything that I could get my hands on, I would run. And my sisters were sweet enough to say, yeah, I'll watch them. My father had no business, had no time for this whatsoever. Eventually he would, but that wasn't his bag. I had to seek out these films. I had to learn how to repair them, which is scary the first time a film breaks. I remember when it broke, and I thought, what happened here? And then I grabbed the splicer. It was a quick splice splicer that I had. And then, of course, I graduated. I mean, you know, it's funny thinking about how tough it was when I was a kid. But, boy, that I was projecting, and I could stop the projector and rewind it, and I could slow motion the film. I was in control. I was in control of this thing, and I really loved it. But I also cared for my films very well. I really loved them, and I didn't have anything at that time that had what is called vinegar syndrome,
mm-hmm.
which is, as you know, film cancer for acetate. And I loved the whole idea that I could put my name on the box. It's from the Stan Taffel Film Collection. And then I even, all the things I did, I filmed my name on 8mm, and I spliced it into the beginnings of a lot of my 8mm films, so it would say, from the Stan Taffel Film Collection. I just got ridiculous with it. But, you know, it's better than drugs, my mom would say.
It certainly is.
Yeah.
And did you make the move to Super 8 sound and all that as the transition? Did you start getting those?
You named the format. I had it.
Yeah.
I went to a friend's house. I haven't talked to this guy in decades. I'm going to mention his name, Cliff Feiner. He was older than me, and he had a Super 8 sound UMIG 810 dual projector.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the first day that I went to his house to watch film, he showed me, among other things, Helpmates, the Laurel and Hardy short, in Super 8 sound. Sound was gorgeous, the picture looked great, and I couldn't eat or sleep for days thinking that I could have these films in sound now. I didn't need to have the silent versions of these sound films. And I remember working and saving up enough money to get the projector. And then I started to collect the films before I even had the projector. And then I went to Super 8 sound. And then I discovered that before Super 8 sound, or around the time, they had Standard 8 sound. And then I found out that Black Hawk Films had made better prints in Standard 8 than Super 8, so I was recollecting things. And then I would collect them until I had the whole collection. Those Black Hawk Films pink colored Laurel and Hardy boxes, which they eventually changed to green, which ticked off a lot of us collectors who wanted to really have the entire collection in the same color boxes. I know, it's geeky, and I'm proud to say that I was one of those who had to have them all in pink boxes. But then when I saw what a print down looked like, a 16mm print right from 35 of these same Laurel and Hardy films, then I started collecting the 16s all over again. And so before you know it, I had, you know, duplicates in different gauges. So that was sad that I had to sell them, too. But, you know, what was the point? You know, you had to sell your collection.
Well, sure. It's just part of your childhood. You don't want to let go. And I never did get a Super 8 projector, a Super 8 sound projector, but I bought several films thinking that I was going to get one.
Mm.
But it just so happened that Super 8 sound came along at about the same time that I realized that you could collect 16 prints. And so I skipped that step because I went straight from 8mm to 16mm and bought a nice Bell & Howell projector, an old, like, World War II vintage Bell & Howell projector. Mm-hmm. And started collecting prints. And then when I started working at film companies, then I could just bring home prints to watch. Everybody would just let you take them home at night if you wanted to. And most people in the offices didn't care enough to take any home. But I did. I took home stuff every night and just watched everything. So I was at Disney and then at Audio Branded and then at Films Inc. So my collecting pretty much stopped around that time because I didn't need to collect. I was just, I had my plate full all the time.
Did you have a library at in your nearby home where you could rent 16 millimeter films for free?
When I lived in Chicago in Park Ridge, Illinois, the library there had 16 millimeter prints you could check out. And when I was a kid, when I first started discovering silent films at probably age 12, our local library had Black Hawk and Castle films that you could check out. So I would bring home. That was an amazing discovery, that we had this 8mm projector that we just used for home movies. And then suddenly, wait a minute, I can watch Buster Keaton on this? This is amazing. So, and I remember the very first film I ever checked out and brought home was The Tramp. And it was a big influence on me because, for one thing, I didn't consider it primarily a comedy. It seemed kind of sad to me. It seemed, you know, the story of this guy who loves this girl and can't have her and never will have her. And it had funny moments, of course, but it struck me more as a sad film than a funny film. And especially the ending and all that stuff. But that was a big deal, and I started off with Chaplin too, so it was.
I can't get over how great he was at such an early stage for film. You know, I'm a fan of the Keystones. I can't sit and watch, you know, 20 Keystone comedies in a row because it's really repetitive. But Chaplin, for some reason, in the late 80s, I spent an entire weekend. And I went through all of the Keystones, the SNAs, the Mutuals, and the First Nationals because I wanted to see them. And when you watch it, you're watching the Genesis, and you're watching every little movement that he made, and you actually see how seasoned and professional he became. And so I can watch the Keystones realizing this is great proving ground. This is how great. Then you get to the new janitor, and there's a moment in there where he is unjustly fired, and he's actually taken a moment. He took, I guess, what an actor would call, he takes a beat.
Yeah.
And in a Keystone film, you don't take beats, you take beatings.
Yeah.
And there he is, taking that moment where he got. Then, of course, at the end of the film, he becomes vindicated, and then he goes back to the, you know, the knockabout character that he was doing. But that was that first moment I remember seeing that, boy, this guy's got, like, a heart. There's a different dimension. Then you get to The Tramp, which, as much as I love that film, if you watch a Black Hawk print, you're actually watching a truncated version of it because there is footage, key footage that is missing from that because there's actually a little bit more of that film that establishes his character and his admiration for Edna in that movie. And I loved my Black Hawk print, but I remember finding other prints and I cobbled together the sequences that were missing from the Black Hawk until I had a print that I couldn't even fit on the reel anymore because I had to get a bigger reel to accommodate it. And then, of course, The Vagabond, which for me is almost perfect. It's 20 minutes, and it tells the whole story.
Yeah.
It tells everything. He loves this girl. He falls madly head over heels in love with Edna, and then she ends up splitting, but then she realizes what just happened. You know, he's just, it's the first time you actually see him almost in tears at the end of that film when he's sitting on the back of the caravan.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, what other movies of this era are doing this and in 20 minutes?
Yeah.
And so, you know, there are people who don't understand today, and sadly there are people that don't even know who Chaplin is. But I certainly see so much of modern stars today doing things that I knew Chaplin did 100 years ago.
Yeah.
And these people don't even know who they have to thank for what they're doing today.
Well, for some reason today it's really unfashionable to like sentimentality. And so, rightly or wrongly, Chaplin gets painted with that brush of being a sentimental, because he'll mix sentiment with comedy. And a lot of people think that that's, I don't know, they beat up on Jerry Lewis for the same thing, although Jerry Lewis does not do it well, according to me, he doesn't. But Chaplin did it beautifully. The kid is a perfectly emotional film, you know. It's got great comedy sequences, but it is at heart an emotional drama about this man and this little boy. And so I think he had a definite, he never imposed sentimentality onto his films. I think he really told stories that just worked through all that different kind of emotion.
I think Chaplin loved to go through the lens to the people in the audience. There's a moment in The Gold Rush, I'll use that moment, where the girls never show up for the New Year's Eve.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually turns around and he's practically looking in the camera. And it's almost as if he is saying to us, did you just see what happened?
Yeah.
And then you go to Buster Keaton in Sherlock Jr., where the scenes keep changing on him during the movie theater sequence. And Keaton is the opposite. You are the audience, I am film, we will never meet.
Yeah.
And so there's a great parallel, and yet it's not even a parallel, it's a complete opposite. And but again, you know, for me, you know, the great Rat Pack of silent film, the clowns, Chaplin, Keaton, and Lloyd. You know, each one of them is Frank, one of them is Sammy, one of them is Dean. You know, they all have their own geniuses, but it's a different kind of genius. And I love Keaton too, which, I love Harold Lloyd.
I do too.
And I think of all the great silent comedians, of which Chaplin will always be my favorite, if I was going to introduce someone to silent film, I would introduce them to Harold Lloyd.
I would too. Absolutely.
Right. He's the one. He is the guy who I think audiences can mostly identify with today. And as a result, that's the way to get people involved in a silent film. Because when it's over, no one ever said, silent film. That was a silent film.
Yeah.
Because you forget. you completely forget it.
Yeah. I think, to me, Keaton is the greatest of them all. I think he's the most inventive mind. But I agree. Although I will say that under almost any circumstances, you can show Sherlock Jr. to almost anybody, and they will love it.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Because it's so ingenious that you forget after 2 minutes that it was made 90 years ago.
Right.
You don't care. It doesn't make any difference to you because what you're seeing is so amazing that, and obviously, there are moments when Chaplin has moments like that too, but Lloyd is the great example, because especially the thrill comedies, which are not my favorites, but those still are as thrilling because he shot them in a realistic manner, and you know, whenever I see, you know, I'm still to be convinced about Harry Langdon. He doesn't strike me as being that funny on a general basis, but he also just cheats on so many of his gags and will do rear screen things and stuff that there's no real peril to it. And so there's no real excitement to it. But when you watch Harold Lloyd, he's really there. I mean, obviously he shot it in such a way that he wasn't suicidal, but it's still, what you're seeing is real. You know, what's on the screen is real.
Do you think that today we could show a festival of silent films to young people, and if it's done the proper way, we could convince them that this is a great art still?
I'm sure you could. You know, I know people who are teachers who bring in films to show their kids, and the kids love them. It's all in the way that it's presented. You know, I was listening to an interview with Leonard Maltin. He didn't say this on my podcast, but he said it on somebody else's podcast, that he went to speak to I think it was his daughter's class. They wanted him to come in and speak, and they were being shown Citizen Kane in 20-minute increments every day in a well-lit classroom.
Ooh.
Which is horrible. It's just horrible. And the teacher who is doing that is killing that movie for those kids,
mm-hmm.
and possibly killing any interest in older films, you know, without showing them with some sort of respect and showing them right, you're not doing those kids any favors. And but I think if you showed kids Sherlock Jr. and Safety Last and which Chaplin would you pick? The Gold Rush, maybe? I mean, certainly City Lights.
I would pick Modern Times.
Would you?
I would, because it's, I think, the funniest. I think that it's because it is beautifully filmed. It, you know,
sure.
You have 1936 film technique. And the sequence in the factory. Everybody understands having a low job. Everyone understands working very hard and what that entails. And there are sequences in that show love, hate, authority. And it's the same stuff that he did in the teens and 20s, but it's photographed beautifully, and it's so interesting to watch. For me, I think the funniest Chaplin moment is the food-eating machine.
Hmm.
That was I took my family when I was 10 to the 1972 reissue, and no one wanted to go, but my mom, God bless my mom, without her, I wouldn't have even gotten to see these things on the big screen. My first impressions of Chaplin were at festivals that she would take me to. I love you, Mom. I hope you hear this someday. But you know that. But in Modern Times, we sat there and laughed our pants off. My sister, who, my baby sister was she was six. We got back in the car when that was over, and she was pretending that she was in the food eating machine, and she was smacking her face with the napkin, and my mom was laughing and said, Stan, from now on, you pick the movies that we go see, because that was the best film we've ever seen. And they all agreed. And yet, I go back to today, you know, there are things that I find in a Chaplin film that a lot of people haven't found. That's how great he was.
Sure.
And here, The Rink, 1916, released in December of 1916. So this is now a picture that people would have seen, five generations more could have seen it now. There's a sequence where he is demonstrating how sharp his knife is before he cuts into the turkey on the table. And he picks a piece of hair out of his scalp, and he cuts it, and he watches the half that fell down to the floor. And he doesn't overact it, but you realize he's watching that hair go down. Okay? You would think the sequence would be over, but not for Chaplin. The scene goes on, the people who are sitting at the table continue, they're waiting for the food, and Chaplin has that other half of hair, the little strand, in his between his fingers. And what does he do? He takes it, and he slightly opens his shirt and puts it on his chest and continues on, okay? You will never see Keaton do that. You will never see Harold Lloyd do that. So it's, you know, it's like watching Chaplin. You got to be good at calculus to catch every moment, because I'm still finding things in 100-year-old films. But Lloyd, you know, the everyman, whether you show Safety Last, which I guess is the one I would show first, not Phantom of the Opera, which generally has become the one silent film that modern audiences do know, and
that's
I know.
That's a horrible thing, okay. Yes, yeah.
You and I have such great camaraderie in certain things, which I love. You know, I could sit with Frank Thompson and talk about, you know, films like It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, and we agree. Safety Last, we agree. I love Speedy because I'm a New York City boy.
Sure.
And I saw it at the Film Forum, and we all stood up when he went through Washington Square Park. But you're not going to get that in Illinois or Chicago which is Illinois or California.
Chicago's only kind of Illinois.
Well, yeah.
But my favorite Lloyd, and I think it might be yours too, is the kid brother.
Absolutely.
And, but I think it's one that you have to grow to.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that I would take that as an introduction to silent film,
no.
Because it's, again, it's part drama, part comedy, and the comedic parts are brilliant,
mm-hmm.
But the most brilliant scene in the film is not necessarily a funny scene, which is climbing the tree, as the girl is going over the hills and everything. That's one of the greatest sequences mm-hmm. in movie history, as far as I'm concerned. But it's not necessarily funny, it's just amazing, you know. But it's also touching, and it's got all that emotion to it as well.
We are lucky in that your friend Kevin Brownlow made that wonderful two-part documentary and explained how they had to build an apparatus that has never been built before just to film this one sequence, which lasts maybe a minute and a
maybe,
half.
Maybe, yeah.
And it is, for me, that moment and the moment in Speedy when Harold Lloyd redesigns the interior of the truck.
Yeah.
And it looks like an actual living room. Mm-hmm. That, to me, is so wonderful. And yet, when that film was re-released by Time Life in 1974, that was the first sequence to go. And I just, so again, you now have different decades determining what is better, and that is a big problem with trying to convince people to see a lot of these films, even though you can see a lot of them now. It's getting big audiences to see them.
Yeah.
So.
And it's also that people, I think now more than any other point in history, we are mostly concerned only with what is contained within our own lives. Mm-hmm. And more people look at anything outside of their own lifetimes as being irrelevant. And so, mm-hmm. Why would I watch that? It's just this old thing with, you know, that has nothing for me in it. Only, you know, well, even I heard somebody refer to Star Wars as an old movie the other day. So when that happens, you realize that there's not much context for film history. But at the same time, we have more access to these films in good prints and restored prints than ever. And that brings me back to what I was saying earlier, that I think sometimes the chase gives us the affection, and when something is just handed to us, you know, it doesn't mean anything. I know friends who have kids, and at Christmas time, they give them 100 presents. Mm-hmm. And kids don't care about any of them. You know, they just don't. Because, you know, I wasn't neglected as a kid. I got a pretty good Christmas every year. Mm-hmm. But it was 3 or 4 presents. You know, it was.
Oh, yeah.
And one of those was socks. So, But you know, it's the wanting something, and I think that's possibly it. You know, it's just you got to figure out some way to introduce these people to not only to the films, but to a context by which they can watch the films.
You know, speaking of that, I told you the story though, but I want to repeat it for your listeners here. That it was the beginning of this year, 2014, that Safety Last was being run at the Granada Theater in Santa Barbara. They were reopening the theater after a major restoration. I had never been inside the theater.
That was beautiful.
Oh, yeah. My goodness. My wife agreed, let's go, and they were running Safety Last. And so I was elated that it was Safety Last on a big screen. Of course, being a film guy, I wanted to know, are they going to run a 35? Or are they going to run, you know, a DCP? And in fact, they did, but it didn't matter because it was going to be gorgeous anyway. And it had live musical accompaniment by a mutual friend of ours, Michael Mortilla. He's been on here with you talking. So, well, Michael was in the, I say orchestra pit, but it was just the piano and him. And my wife, I told her, the fact that you're letting me go to this, please, whatever seat you want. And my wife likes the balcony. She's an old-fashioned girl. Likes the balcony, and we're in a movie palace, so I'm there. I saw Michael, and he actually saw me, and what am I, 200 feet away from him? And he realized it was me, and he put up his hands with a question mark, like, what are you doing here? And so he texted me, and I texted back, we're here to see you, man. Well, I'm listening to people all around me, because all of the seats were giveaway seats. It was a free concert, basically, to hear Michael play. Oh, and they're running a silent movie, too. Mm-hmm. So they're saying, well, you know, we had nothing to do with the kids, so we figured, well, you know, pretty theater, we'll see it, and, you know, it's a movie, maybe we'll stay 10 minutes. And one guy, I don't know why I'm here, he says. I don't know, what is it? All right, fine. His friends wanted to go. So I am in a packed theater. I think there were about 1,100 people there, who most of which, because I didn't recognize anyone that I know from any of the film festivals or the screenings I go to. It's a completely novice audience, most of which have never seen a silent film projected like this. And it's Safety Last. Well, this picture starts, Oh, and I should tell you also, my wife had only seen one Harold Lloyd film because I made the cardinal mistake of showing her The Kid Brother first. Well, film, yeah, well, but, you know, she...
It's an easy mistake to make.
Yeah, okay, right. I was so happy she said I could run something for her.
Sure.
So the film begins, and as that film starts, as you know, there's you know, you're watching something, and of course, Lloyd does what Keaton always did, which is, you know, pull a switch on you in the beginning. So when you think he's going to the gallows, you know, he's actually basically leaving to go into town on a new venture on a train. Well, the audience was watching this, and they were laughing, but laughing like, look, it was surprised. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's kind of cute. And then the sequence when he's supposed to get on, you know, he got on the wrong trolley, the back of the, I forget what it was now that I'm talking about, but he was holding on to the rail, he grabbed the wrong car.
Yeah.
Audience.
Like a streetcar.
Thank you. He got on the streetcar instead, and the audience is laughing really loudly. And then people are whispering. And I could hear some of the whispers, like, that was good. Wow. Because they've never seen visual comedy. They hear it. They see it. They see it in color. They see it widescreen. But they've never watched a movie in which you have to listen with your eyes to understand what's going on. You close your eyes, you won't see it. This film progresses, the audience is laughing more and more. I have never heard an audience laugh this much in a movie theater, maybe ever in my life. And I've seen a lot of film, and a lot of silent film, but when they get to the sequences in which Lloyd is climbing the building, they are nuts. They're screaming in shock, because they think he's really up there, because there's something about CGI and real life that you'll never 100% be able to do. They went nuts. Well, while I'm watching this film, and I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about it again, because for me, the greatest silent theater experience I ever had was probably the same one you had, which was at San Francisco to see Napoleon, when Carl Davis came and conducted it for 7.5 hours. This is so close to that. And it was only, you know, 75 minutes. Well, they were screeching and loving it that I was looking down at Mortilla playing, and he had never played better that I had ever heard. He was so involved with the audience that I knew that he was having an actual moment of triumph here. This is a moment that he's never going to forget. And as it turned out, the audience was cheering. And when the film was over, people were talking. What was it? Harold Lloyd? Okay, are his films available? And people started to huddle in groups. And my wife went to the restroom. And since all these people were saying, where can you see Harold Lloyd's films? And not being shy in any way, I said, many of them are available. And by the time my wife got back into the lobby, there were 40 people that were in a circle around me as I'm telling them where they can find these films and that you saw the best one to see. I go home that night and I have a message from Michael Mortilla, and he says, what did you think? I can't believe this. And I said, Michael, what you gave 1,100 people, and he even said that I've never played like that. That was one that can never be duplicated. And then he, on Facebook, he took a 10-minute section so you can hear him play, but it wasn't to hear him play. He wanted people to hear how audiences were responding. You heard that thing.
Sure. Yeah.
That, and I was getting goosebumps all over again remembering that moment, and that's something I will never forget. So once again, back to what we said much earlier, you want to introduce people to a silent comedy and get them involved and turn them into fans. Safety Last, for me, is the one you start with. It's a no-brainer.
And no matter what you do, if you can get them into a theater to watch it with an audience, that's going to really help cinch the deal. Because, you know, just what you're talking about, that huge reaction from people, it's exciting and it gets into your blood. And that's I've always regretted that I didn't go to that screening, but it's a great lesson to learn because, you know, me, I've seen Safety Last 50 times probably.
Sure.
And I've heard Michael Mortilla accompany films 100 times. And I love Michael and I love his playing and I love the film. But I just thought, why should I drive up to Santa Barbara to see something that I've seen so much? But, you know, it was such a great experience. Now I'm sorry I didn't do it.
Now you remember, because we were there, by the time we got to the fourth section of Napoleon in San Francisco, and the audience was cheering the orchestra and Carl,
oh, yeah.
You saw their faces, and they were talking about how they'd never played so hard, and because
sure.
The audience was, because normally when they play concerts, you know, musicians, you know, they're playing the music and, you know, there's a polite audience and they're loving it. But we were such an interactive crowd. They, because they're performers, they're thespians in a way. They're feeding off of our reactions. So I learned that lesson. And that's one of the reasons I went to Safety Last, because, well, the theater in itself I wanted to see. But if I see a screening, like City Lights is going to be playing in the same theater next year. And I'm going just because I want to see
sure.
an audience enjoy Chaplin, and so I can just sit there with a smirk on my face saying, see?
Well, I haven't seen City Lights with an audience in probably 20 years or more, so I would certainly do that, because I've seen it many times since.
Oh, sure.
But, an audience makes so much of a difference.
And I think that, because we talked about what were, I guess, considered the three kings of comedy, Chaplin, Keaton, and Lloyd, and you mentioned the thing about Langdon, which I have to agree. I didn't understand why he was put in that position of the fourth great one, because quite frankly, if I was rewriting that list and if I was to put a fourth person, it would not be a person, it would be persons.
It would be Larry Seaman.
Larry Seaman and Gustav von Seifert.
Yes. Yes.
No, I would put Laurel and Hardy in there.
Oh, sure.
They are, of all the great visual comedians, especially in the silent films, they were as great to me as Chaplin, Keaton, and Lloyd.
Oh, absolutely they are.
And I'll tell you something else.
They're the very best of the best.
Yeah. I think Stan Laurel is the only one of all of them. Even Oliver Hardy, and I love Oliver Hardy, so I'm not knocking him, but he's the one great clown that I have never seen giving a performance. You know, Chaplin looking at the camera or
mm-hmm.
being so exquisite with his fingers and the way he dances. Well, he's given us a show, and he's very well aware there's a
sure.
camera in front of him. And Keaton was so aware that there was a camera in front of him, he cut it off completely. And Lloyd, you know, the way he would angle his face, you know, to do that great smile, the go-getter face that he would do, and the way he positioned his body, he's aware of the camera. Stan Laurel, it was almost as if we were just catching you know, a real moment in time where he just... I've never caught him acting, except maybe in Chump at Oxford when he plays the rich you know, version of himself. But I would put them right up there. And they have stood the test of time probably better than anybody else.
Yeah.
And,
they were probably more instrumental in giving me a taste for older film than anybody else. Possibly our gang is right mm-hmm. up there with them. Because when I was a kid, it was still in the days when there were local TV stations that did local programming.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the morning, starting at probably 6, I think it went from like 6 to 8, there was a kid show.
Mm-hmm.
And they played cartoons, and they played Our Gang, and they played Laurel and Hardy,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes the Three Stooges.
Yeah.
Then in the afternoon, at about 4 o'clock, there's another kid show.
Right.
And they're playing that same stuff. And that's where I'm seeing the Max Fleischer cartoons and mm-hmm. the Warner Brothers cartoons. And I've always said that because they showed the Laurel and Hardys and Our Gangs from 1929,
mm-hmm.
I never knew them to show a silent, but they always showed from the very earliest
mm-hmm.
sound films, that when I got to a 1929 serious film, it was not a shock to me. I understood the cadences mm-hmm. and I understood the film grammar and all of that stuff because I'd already gotten it painlessly from Laurel and Hardy and Our Gang. I mean, just unaccustomed as we are and what is it? Small Talk? Is that the
That's
first?
That's the first one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so those were 1929 films.
Mm-hmm.
And I think now, if just a kid who has never seen any older film, if you showed him a 1929 drama,
mm-hmm.
I think it would be such a big jump for them in terms of style and in terms of
mm-hmm.
of acting style, I'll just repeat, that it might be rough for them to make the transition.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought that Laurel and Hardy and Our Gang were the doorway for me.
Oh, yeah.
And So I never had any problem with it. And indeed, from the very first beginning, and I wonder if this was the same kind of thing for you, that one of the most important things to me was the fact that they were old. And as soon as I realized that I was just seeing all these great cars and just, mm-hmm. oh, look, that's what their phones were like, and this is how they opened right. a can of milk. And, mm-hmm. you know, pardon me, I've got milk in my ear. And
going by 1934,
yeah.
what a geek I am that I know that.
But everything about that world was fascinating to me, just how they dressed and what, you know, what men's hats looked like and all that. And I think that's a big part of it for me.
I moved out to California ultimately because of the Hal Roach Studios films. My favorite music is the music from the Hal Roach Studios films.
Sure.
My favorite styles of houses, the Spanish Mediterranean looks, are from a lot of those films that you see that were shot in Culver City.
Yeah.
My favorite cars. I still, to this day, want to own a Model A. And recently I got a chance to sit in one, and somebody was very excited that I knew where everything was in the car because of the Laurel and Hardy films and the R-Gang films as well. I did not think of them as old when I watched the R-Gang films. You show Pups is Pups, a 1931 film, which is more drama than comedy.
Yeah.
Well, everybody loves a dog, and when you see that sure. There's going to be a problem and a dog is about to be euthanized, and the kid can't
oh, yeah.
help. Oh my God, that thing! And I was in tears as a kid watching that.
Sure,
but it doesn't matter how old it was. Those films tug at the humanity, which is why you can watch the R-Gang films. I think today you can run any of the films from even the early 30s in a theater before a modern feature film, and those audiences will laugh like they've never laughed before.
Yeah,
and Laurel and Hardy, there's something perfect about these two guys. Who, if you go down through the decades, the other great teams like Gleason and Carney, Fred Flintstone and Barney. Well, who do they remind you of? I mean, there were others too, but yeah, Laurel and Hardy have been the biggest influence. Hal Roach, the studio,
yeah.
biggest influence on my life, I think.
Well, speaking of Roach, let's talk a little bit about Charlie Chase because he's your other favorite.
Oh yeah,
and he's someone I admire him a great deal, and when he's good, I think he's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
He does not have a flawless track record, as far as I'm concerned. There are times when he really doesn't. His films are just okay.
Oh, and not even just okay.
Yeah.
As a silent film actor, comedian, he was terrific. I prefer his silent films much more to his sound films. That isn't to say he didn't do some really good sound films. He did. But his contribution to film is much greater than his appearances in them. He was a great filmmaker. He started the same time Chaplin did in 1914 at Keystone, and they worked together at Keystone. Matter of fact, I remember when I was watching Doe and Dynamite in the 70s, I said, who's that guy at the table? He's really funny, because he's the only one who's living the moment. Again, actor terms. He's living the moment right now when everyone else is doing the bigger-than-life, oh, you know, Del Sartre-type movements.
Sure.
But he was living it, and then I realized, okay, this is Charles Parrott, and Charles Parrott, the real last name for Charlie Chase. And so, through the years, he became a good writer, a good director, a good producer. By the time he goes to Hal Roach, he is named the director general of the studio, which means he supervised all production at the studio, the same way DeMille supervised production at famous Players Lasky. And then, when Harold Lloyd was moving on to features, and moving away from Roach, in fact, Snub Pollard took over from Second Banana to First Banana, and Roach wanted another series and threw Chase into a series. And it was a series of one-reel shorts, and most of those shorts are really good. They're certainly better than the Chaplin one-reelers because it's 10 years later. There are much more technical advances in film. But Chase was packing so much into a one-reel film that Roach said, let's move you into two reels, which was fine, so he could even the pace out. But then, when sound came in, as it did for so many of those great comedians, the sound microphone, that just took over for so many people, and it was a little daunting. So Chase, who could sing, had a great singing voice, decides to, you know, continue the series, and unfortunately, the biggest problem with the Chase films at this period is that, and I don't think people were realizing it back then, Charlie brought people to Roach. Charlie brought talent, behind the scenes and in front, to Hal Roach, and they started in his films. And so his series was the absolute proving ground at the Roach Studio. Leo McCarey comes in, and he works with Chase in dozens of films.
Yeah.
But then, oh, we cannot contain this genius. Let's move him somewhere else. Well, back in the late teens, Charlie had met Babe Hardy, and they worked together. Babe Hardy, who is Oliver Hardy, of course, comes to Roach because of Charlie Chase. And they do five films together. And then, wait a second, let's move him into other stuff, too. All of the people that started with Chase that moved on, who had, you know, greater fame, did great in sound. Chase was losing... He wasn't getting enough people into the studio anymore, and so he was relying on, you know, his talent more than anything else. He didn't have Leo McCarey to work with anymore, or Oliver Hardy. He would bring in friends like Gail Henry to do certain films. And when you get to those sound films, he decides to be what I like to consider, of course, it's the wrong parallel, but there's a period of Charlie Chase's films in which he's very much like Ernie Kovacs. He's being experimental. He's doing things no one's ever done before. And there's a particular film, and I have some friends who get real upset when I talk about how interesting this movie is, even though it's not a great movie, but it was an interesting experiment. It's a film called Life Hesitates at 40, in which Charlie tells the doctor, you know, I've been having this strange feeling that sometimes everything stops all around me, but I keep going on. And basically what Charlie does in this movie is he actually has the film freeze for 2, 3, 4 seconds, and then it resumes again. And it's just so fascinating that he would do that. And yet, I'll show this film to someone, and they go, why did you waste my time? And I just think, well, tell me another movie that did that before this. You know, they all can't be home runs, but, you know, Charlie's series did that. He had other ones. He did, you know, he would do one-joke films. He did a film called Fallen Arches, which I do know some people think is one of his best movies, and for me, it's a one-joke film that is a semi-snore fest because it's one joke. He takes people literally as to what they say. He you know, if you say something to him, he will think exactly what you said. It's exact words.
Sure.
So his sound films are, you know, some of them are such a misfire. But I love him because he was the only comedian who absolutely got the girl even before the film started, because he wasn't one of the grotesque comics. And he's getting discovered again, and I'm happy about that.
Yeah, they're finally releasing some of his stuff on DVD. Although they haven't put out Arabian Tights yet.
I think you have that somewhere in your vast archive.
And it's actually not a very good
there
film.
You go.
That's the trouble. But it is in the Foreign Legion, so, you know, I've got to have it.
And it's and you know, the Hal Roach films, I'll just touch on this real quickly. The Laurel and Hardys are terrific. The R-Gangs are terrific. Yeah, there are a couple of kind of clinkers in there, but I wouldn't even... They're not full-on clinkers.
Not many.
Be Big, for me, is 10 minutes too long. That whole boot, taking off the boot sequence. What was going on there? But the other series that were done at that studio never were as good. Even the Chases, they were never as good as the Laurel and Hardys and the R-Gangs. So we're grateful to Hal Roach for what he gave us, but he did give us a lot of stuff that is less than memorable.
Yeah, it's really interesting to me to look at all these other series, because I think I've seen examples of all of them. I believe I have.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones with Zazu Pitts and Thelma Todd have their moments, mm-hmm. but by and large, they're not all that great. The ones with Patsy Kelly, to me, I don't like Patsy Kelly very much, and mm-hmm. they're even less great.
mm-hmm.
At least in the Thelma Todd ones, you got Thelma Todd, you
right.
know, so. And I love Zazu Pitts. I think she's so funny. But neither one of them was shown to her best advantage in those shorts. And the boyfriend shorts are mostly a snore. Mm. And the Taxi Boys, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Taxi Boys?
Yeah.
So it's really interesting to me that Roach could give us what is eternally the greatest comedy of all time, and then at the same time just... series after series of mediocre comics. It's just weird.
Well, you did mention it right now. You said Thelma Todd, Zazu Pitts, Patsy Kelly, Thelma Todd, the Taxi Boys. Laurel and Hardy were the first great comedy team, and he was trying in vain to replicate it
yeah.
any way he could. And that's the problem. The Billy Gilbert Ben Blue story that was told about the Taxi Boys series, which was a 1932 season series, was we're going to pair Ben Blue with Billy Gilbert because Billy's been a proven guy for our studio.
Sure.
We're going to bring Ben Blue, a vaudevillian, in. And Ben Blue said to Billy Gilbert, you know, every comedy duo, they have a straight man and a funny man, and I'm pretty funny. And Billy Gilbert patted Ben Blue on the shoulder and said, every man for himself. And that is not how you start a comedy series.
It is
series.
Not, no.
So,
and Ben Blue is not pretty funny, as far as I can tell.
He's a good dancer.
Oh, boy, yeah.
Yeah, that's just it. But you know what? Hal did something that no one else ever did in that era. He actually showed people that even when you're down on your luck, you can still rise above it and be funny. And Laurel and Hardy, they did that, you know, never, I think it was one film where Ollie was well off, he was getting married, and Chickens Come Home. But in most of those films, they were Depression-era guys in that old Model A
mm-hmm.
that was, you know, going to break down at some point. But we loved it because we were rooting for them. And there was such heart. My favorite Laurel and Hardy moment, and this is just a Laurel and Hardy moment that no one ever cites, but for me, it typifies everything about that studio and the relationship. And it's in Pardon Us, their first full-length feature that they start in. And Stan has a bad tooth, and they make him go to the dentist in the jail and have it taken care of. And Stan Laurel, who is that little crying little innocent baby, and he's scared, and we instantly understand dentists and the fear. And out of nowhere, Oliver Hardy shows up because he knows that Stan's going to be scared. Now, how did he escape from his jail cell? We never know. But all of a sudden, he's just there, and then he sits down next to Stan without Stan knowing. And when Stan turns around and sees him, he immediately locks arms with Ollie. And it's for that one moment. It's just, you're here. I'm safe. You know, it is not homosexual.
No.
It is not anything to do with any kind of romantic. It is a best friend, brother, being there for his other brother. And I love that moment because I have never seen other comedy duos do that.
No.
No other studio. It's and I know that is just a moment. No words. It's no words, but it's, for me, it typifies everything I love about those guys. They're the greatest.
I think that hits the nail on the head because the fact that these two guys love each other is the basis of everything for this. And it's why, as much as I find other comedy teams funny, I never find them as transcendent as Laurel and Hardy. Because Abbott and Costello, good example. Mm-hmm. These are funny guys, and they do funny things. But as characters, they hate each other. And Bud Abbott will sell out Costello for anything.
Mm-hmm.
Hope and Crosby, same thing.
Mm-hmm.
They have an antagonistic relationship. Funny films, and I love them together, but they are not friends. You know, they really don't.
Right.
Bing Crosby will sell out Bob Hope under any circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
Martin and Lewis.
Oh, yeah.
Same thing.
Oh, yeah.
But Laurel and Hardy, they will fight among themselves like kids. They will hit mm-hmm. each other or scrap or whatever when they get mad at each other. But they will never allow somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Oliver Hardy will slap Stan or kick him or whatever, and mm-hmm. usually it leads to him getting worse
right.
in return. But he would never let somebody else pick on Stan. Mm-hmm. He just wouldn't. Whereas Bud Abbott would absolutely let somebody pick on Lou Costello. Absolutely he would.
I love that when Laurel and Hardy, who were only doing short subjects from up until 31, before they started doing some features, you watch their films, and they're just shorts. Just, you know, filler on a program. And yet, when MGM is trying to, you know, tout the great stars of their studio, they always brought Laurel and Hardy in.
Yeah.
And they even put him in Hollywood Party, and Pick a Star and, you know, featured them because these guys were hot at the time. But Laurel and Hardy didn't know it, which, again, baffles me. But, you know, media then is different than the media today. And why would it take them to go on a tour of overseas and they are greeted like the way we think Elvis and the Beatles would have been greeted
sure.
in their day? And it was true. And yet these guys did not make tons of dough at Hal Roach. And yet I think that without Hal Roach, they never would have been able to do the type of independent creativeness that they were able to do. You know, I always said that Hal Roach needed Stan Laurel as much as Stan Laurel needed Hal Roach. And I only say that because Stan was the behind-the-scenes creative force.
Sure.
But, you know, so I always compared them to Cagney and Warner and Betty Davis and Jack Warner.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the best work that was done at those studios by the two people that would always butt heads. And so when I hear about how much money Stan made and Babe made, and it really was just ridiculous, and there is some talk now that Roach tried to get Laurel and Hardy back in 1941, back to the studio, and Stan was not going to let that happen, and Stan and Babe, you know, had finally joined, officially, they were never officially a team on paper at
yeah.
Roach until Chump at Oxford. And so they start this company, and then all of a sudden, the guy wants him back. They wanted to do streamliners with them, you know, war comedies. But they opted to go to Fox. And, you know, I'm one of the people that does not dislike the Fox films the way some people do. And, you know, yeah.
I can take them or leave them. I mean, there are some really funny things, I'm sure.
But it's also, these are great comedians who are in their 50s now. They're not in their 30s doing comedy. You know, and physical comedy, forgive me, it is a young guy's
sure
or young girl's game. And, you know, the time was, you know, catching up with them. That's that's all it is. Time caught up with Abbott and Costello. Time caught up with everybody.
Everybody. Except James Dean.
Except.
But this is not an original thought, but I don't remember where I read it. Somebody said, when you see, you know, a brick fall on the head of a 30-year-old guy mm-hmm. and he does a take, it's funny.
Right.
But if you see that fall on the head of a 60-year-old guy, you just think, oh, man,
you're so right.
Is he okay, you know? And so it's not the same thing. It's not the same kind of... not the same kind of comedy.
And yet, here's a great moment. It's sort of what you're talking about, but I'm going to go back to Harold Lloyd and then Oliver Hardy. You talk about you know, young guys. In Safety Last, Harold Lloyd hanging from the building. Sometimes you hear his mouth. You hear his mouth. Listen to me. You see him yell. You don't hear it.
Yeah.
Okay. So one of the senses, because it's a silent film, you have to fill in for yourself. And yet, when he does Feet First in 1930, and he's yelling and screaming from the building, you don't feel the same sense of danger, because he's yelling. Well, that's what you expect. And yet, Oliver Hardy came up with something utterly brilliant that has not been stolen by a lot of other comedians. And it's a reaction to pain that no one ever got. So this is the sequence. So those of you who are listening, you'll grab your DVD of the 1930 film Bratz, and you'll watch this. And I'm telling you, this is exactly what I'm talking about, why Oliver Hardy was so brilliant. There's a sequence when they are in this film where they play themselves and they play their children. And they're in the bathroom, and Oliver Hardy has fallen into the gigantic tub of water,
mm-hmm.
and Stan is pulling him out to try to dry him off. And something from a shelf, which is a bottle of liniment, topples over, and it's just pouring. And it's pouring conveniently into a hole in Oliver Hardy's pajamas. And the hole is right where his ass is.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, Oliver Hardy, who was, you know, crying because he's wet, all of a sudden he's looking in the camera and he stops crying. And he is slowly trying to figure out what is trickling in his pants. And he's puzzled by it. And he's wondering, and then his eyes open a little, realizing, this is uncomfortable. This is hot. And then when he realizes what it is the slowest scream you've ever heard. And there's one guy who made the anticipatory scream funny. And I just think that it's perfect. And that is why Laurel and Hardy, you show them in a theater today, Who cares that films are 80, 90 years old? People are going to laugh because they get it. They understand. He gives us time to realize what's happening.
They were, in some ways, slow-moving comics. They were very deliberate in a lot of ways, which is one of the things I find funniest about them. Also, a reason that they work much better with audiences than they work at home. I do watch them on my own TV and enjoy them always, of course.
Right.
But they timed in laughter so perfectly, they knew exactly when the laugh was going to start and when it was going to stop. And if there was any doubt about it, Ali could just do a camera look and give it a little bit of leeway one way or the other, but usually that would just start another laugh. I think they put him in there just to let the laughter subside, but then it would usually start another laugh from the audience. So they're brilliantly timed. And it's also, I was thinking about this a while ago, that in terms of the Roach films, the other series, it shows how Head and Shoulders above everybody else were Laurel and Hardy, because they show up in the other series.
Oh yeah,
they show up in Laurel and, in the, Our Gangs. They show up in the Zazu Pitts and Thelma Todd shorts. I don't know if they show up in the Taxi Boys, but I wouldn't be surprised.
They did the chase.
Yeah. So, so just the fact that Roach was saying, okay, these other series need a boost.
Mm-hmm.
Put in Laurel and Hardy because
they're
surefire.
And when you talked about the timing and the editing, which Stan Laurel was in the room with all of them who edited these films, that's what made him really upset in the late 50s when he was watching them on television, because they were just throwing commercials in, not realizing that these were edited for a specific length to generate the maximum.
And timing is everything,
He offered to go in to... I don't know who's running them in L.A. because I was in New York, but he offered to go into the station for free to recut them and show them where to put the commercials in, which they graciously bowed out of.
Yeah.
Who wouldn't want Stan Laurel to come in and...
Absolutely. Can you imagine Stan Laurel says, I'll come into your studio. No thanks. Just stay away.
Man.
Yeah, we got this. Oh, man.
I love that. Yeah.
When did you start thinking that you wanted to go into performing yourself?
That was early, really early on. I loved the whole idea. Well, again, I was influenced by Chaplin. I watched him do things. I could do the dance of the rolls. You give me two forks right now and two French rolls, and I could do it step for step. I loved the reaction of people smiling. I remember, you know, even before grade school, you know, in classes and in shows, they would always give me some standout thing to do, and I loved it. And I loved hearing people laugh. So it was never, it chose me. I didn't choose it. It's always been that way, and I've loved it. I had an ear to sing, so I could copy people's singing styles, and then I ended up doing impressions, and I ended up doing a lot of impressions that nobody knew. You know, because who's you know, my first grade teacher? Who is going to know? But what I did was, because I thought Sammy Davis Jr. was the greatest entertainer in the world who ever set foot on an actual stage for a live performance, and I still feel that. I remember we would gather with family, and I remember saying, okay, this is Stanley Tafel's impression of Sammy Davis Jr. doing his impression of James Cagney. And then I would do the You Dirty Rat and all that stuff. But a lot of my impressions were Sammy's impressions of someone else, and so he's always been a hero to me. And then I realized, okay, Sammy's actually doing impressions of famous people, and then I would, you know, branch out, did voices for cartoons and did voices for answering machines. I was very, 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 I loved it, and I always knew I wanted to do it, but I loved film equally as much. On any given week, I would be doing a performance of a show off Broadway, and I would have a lecture series out in Long Island, and I would run silent film, and I would do the introduction, and I would have live accompaniment for that. So you know, life was the greatest at that young time when I was doing everything I wanted to do. TV started, and I was so happy.
Well, what made you stop doing it then?
I fell in love with my wife.
Hmm.
See, what happened was
women.
This. I don't regret it. I don't regret it. My beautiful wife, Deva, whom I met out here, and the reason I moved out here was because I had been doing live performances across the country of a show called The News in Review, and it was political satire, and we would constantly change the show. We ended up doing television on PBS. We followed Mark Russell, and through a very strange quirk of fate, I won 3 consecutive Emmys for acting on that show. And then
were singing too, weren't you?
Yeah, I was singing. So I would be singing like Ted Kennedy. You know, if something was going on in the news, we would do a story set to musical parody. And I loved that show. I loved everything about that show. I also was able to bring in a couple of very, very close friends to perform in that show. And when the idea was to bring it to television, bring our friends into television as well, so we have a record of us, you know, performing. But by the time of the 3rd Emmy, you know, there were people talking, and even an agent in California who said, "You got to get out here." And so I followed that path, came out here, finding out it is so difficult, and the Emmys mean nothing. I did Make Me Laugh on Comedy Central. I did a few things, but then I was realizing that, all right, it's not happening, and yet I started to get involved with the film industry out here, and then I met my wife, who was just so wonderful, not in show business at all, was interested that I had all of this experience behind me. She saw some photographs of me in my apartment with some of the our gang kids who were adults, but I'm in the picture with them because I became good friends with many of them. And she saw a picture with me and Spanky and freaked out because she says, "I love Spanky. I think our gang, I think those are the greatest things in the world." And I said to her, "Do you want to marry me now or do you want to wait?" Little did I know, that was our first date. And so, I fell in love. But she wanted to be a psychologist at the time, and I wanted to make sure she got her degree. So I told her, "Stop working and I'll take care of you." And we moved in. We weren't 18 years old at the time. We were fully grown adults. And I started making it a living. And I love being with her. And, you know, while I will dabble occasionally and get into things, I recently did a film. This past month I did something. But, you know, I like having the paycheck coming in, so I don't have to do what many of my actor friends do is, you know, worry where the next, you know, paycheck's coming from. So I took the mature route and did that. But, you know, I'm very involved in the film world. I will occasionally do some things. I'll do some audio commentary for DVDs. I'll speak before films. I will meet a lot of terrific celebrities who I grew up loving and seeing them, you know, as older people. And becoming friends with some of them, good friends, actually, with, you know, some of them. It's really a blessing for that. So I'm on stage interviewing these celebrities frequently, and so that does keep me in front of the public, so to speak. So I get my satisfaction that way. Although, after doing this film this past month, it did something to me where I'm thinking, boy, I really did miss that, and that was fun, and the people on the crew saying, "Man, you've done this before, haven't you?" So, yeah.
Well, to be clear, you're talking about Mike Schlesinger's film.
Yes.
The Biffle and Schuster. And what's the title of the one you're in?
Well, Michael Schlesinger, for your fans out here who know...
And he will be on the show eventually.
Okay.
He keeps threatening to come on, so...
But he's too big for us right
yeah,
now.
Right now he is.
Mike put together an idea for a film. He wanted to do a tribute to the two reelers from the 30s and 40s. So he did one a year ago, and it was very interesting. He did it in black and white. He got some good people with it, and he got one of my very best friends, Nick Santamaria, who also created one of the characters for Biffle and Schuster, this supposedly forgotten comedy duo from the 1930s. And so Michael decided that he wanted to do 4 more shorts so he could try to sell it as a package. And so he did 4 more shorts, and they're, each of the titles have spoofs of famous films of the era they're trying to spoof. And the film that I did was called Imitation of Wife. And it's a very small cast. And what Mike did for me and for Nick, because he knew that Nick and I have been wanting to perform together in something. The very first day of filming, Mike decided was the day of letting Nick and Stan riff, go with it. So it only took about 3 hours. We had a couple of sequences, and Nick and I just created some stuff. The same way Stan and Babe and all the people at the Roach Studio might have tried to concoct something. And I think we really put together some good stuff. And with this short cast, we made a two-reel comedy, which we are going to screen at the big film festival out here called Cinecon, which, as you know, I'm vice president of. And I guess we're going to talk about that later. But he did another film called The Bride of Finkelstein, and one that he's doing in two-color Cinecolor, as he called it. I said, don't call it two-color Cinecolor. Just call it Cinecolor, Mike. And it's called Schmoboat. And I went to the other films on the sets to see what was going on, and there were some pretty talented people that were trying to replicate what it was like doing film in the 30s, and I haven't had that much fun on a set since I was doing the News and Review on PBS. It was glorious. So I hope he can sell it, and I hope that he can, you know, generate an interest, because everybody's heart was in the right place.
I was there last week for most of a day watching. They were doing a version of the Niagara Falls bit, and so I had to be on stage or on site for that for reasons you'll learn about later, dear listener. Mm-hmm. But it was fun. It was great fun watching. It was fun because Nick was the man getting beat up in the Niagara Falls sketch, mm-hmm. and Mike had ridden it for three women to come through. So it was actually more of a Susquehanna Hat Company sketch mm-hmm. than a Niagara Falls sketch, but he had these three beautiful women in period costume, you know, 30s dresses. And he said, and Mike told me, the biggest problem he was having with them was they were reluctant to go as big as he wanted them to go. So he kept saying, okay, do another take, but bigger. Niagara Falls! Mm-hmm. So I think it turned out really well. I watched every take and mm-hmm. every rehearsal and everything they did. But when I saw the finished product, or at least one of the finished products, it worked pretty well.
I love the fact that Nick was able to handpick the girls.
Yeah.
He knew them, and he knew what he wanted them to do. And that story about Be Bigger reminds me of Frank Capra watching Harry Langdon filming in the 40s. Yeah. And again, going back to something even early when you talked about, Laurel and Hardy, you know, being more subtle. Harry Langdon was subtle. Yeah. But the point was, he was so aware that he was being subtle, and he was aware there was a camera in front of him. But this Biffle and Schuster thing, and Nick Santa Maria, who played Biffle, and Will Ryan plays Schuster, Sam Schuster. But Benny Biffle, you know, Nick Santa Maria was born decades too late, because this is a guy who really knows this era. He's a writer, and he's written about this era. He knows these comedians. He knows about that style of stage. He's been on Broadway. The man was in The Producers. So Mike Schlesinger, having Nick in that movie is a blessing.
Yeah.
And anyone who sees the movie, maybe you're not the biggest fan of this era, and maybe people who see the film will be confused. One thing you cannot be confused about is the talent of Nick Santa Maria trying to do this piece of business from the 30s. And I thought he did the Slowly I Turned really well.
Yeah.
He deserves a lot of credit for going, you know, because the last girl is a bodybuilder in real life. She mm-hmm. has a washboard stomach. Yeah. I mean, she has the stomach we all want, or okay. But when she smacked him on the last take, his ear was inflamed.
Oh, he said at the end of the day he was bruised. He had bruises all over from the many beatings he took.
And
over
that cigarette in his mouth. I don't know. In that last take, when she smacked him, that cigarette flew like a Babe Ruth home run to right field. It was. I was there for it, and it was. You were probably there too. It was scary.
Sure. I was there the whole time. Yeah.
But boy, he really did suffer for his art that day.
Well, we're fast running out of time, so let's get to Cinecon.
Oh.
This is the 50th anniversary of Cinecon.
We have a film festival out here in California. We hold it at the Egyptian Theater. It is a really interesting festival. I stress to your listeners, if you want to come see Casablanca and Gone with the Wind and The Wizard of Oz, this is not the festival for you. This festival consists largely of motion pictures and short subjects from the silent and sound era that have, in some cases, not been seen since they were first seen at their original release, or haven't been seen since television ran them in the 50s. These are films that we get from the studios who have preserved them, who have allowed us to show them on the big screen, and it's a chance for people to reacquaint themselves with films they might have seen once a long time ago.
I don't know everything about movies, but I am not unknowledgeable about film history. And every year, I'd say the majority of the program is consists of movies that I've never even heard of.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, to me, is the way toward delightfulness. I just love to sit there, watch the curtain open, and then see something I've never seen before. I have no idea what to expect. And speaking of Mike Schlesinger, it reminds me of a funny story, funny to me, that he was writing some of the program notes,
mm-hmm.
and there was what's it called? It was a Gary Cooper, Mary Bryan film set in the Civil War. And I cannot remember the name of it off the top of my head. Forgive me, folks. But anyway, it's like 1930. 30, 31, something like that. And he plays a prisoner of war who has to be kept overnight in this house before they shoot him or something the next morning. But as the film goes on, it becomes more and more like a farce, like a slamming door farce. People going out of this room and into that room, and it turns into a comedy. And it was a delightful switch because I never saw it coming. And then suddenly you realize, wait a minute, this is turning into a funny comedy. And so afterwards I said, I was just standing there talking with somebody. And I said, that was a real surprise. I was delighted to see that. And Mike walked up and he said, well, it wouldn't have been a surprise if you had read my notes in the program. And I said, yeah, I did. I want it to be a surprise. Right. That's why I don't read the notes until afterwards. So. He was puzzled. He was puzzled why you would want to be surprised by something.
My wife's the same way. She will not allow me to show Robert Osborne or Ben Mankiewicz introduce a movie when TCM runs it.
Yeah.
She wants to totally be surprised, and I understand that.
I'm exactly that same way.
And we have people that come to Cinecon who want us to do introductions for all the films, and our introductions never give anything away. One of the things that I love about our festival is that the people who made the films, if they are around, and Cinecon goes back 50 years, so, you know, the stars that came in the 70s
sure.
are not here anymore, but we are getting celebrities that are coming to see their films, and we honor them when they come to Cinecon. But our festival is generally for film fans who really want to see some rare things.
Yeah.
So, you know,
this is for real film buffs.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Turner Classic Festival does a great job, but the people who want to see a film like East is West.
Oh, yes.
Now, this is a picture that we are running, and this is the first time that it is going to be seen in this country since it was made in 1922. That's a Constance Talmadge silent picture she did for First National. I've never seen it, and I am so looking forward to seeing it. And, yeah, we programmed it in a primetime slot because the place is going to be packed.
Sure.
Because we're running 35mm on this thing. But then again, because this is the 100th anniversary of Charlie Chaplin's first appearance in film, we're running some of his earlier film shorts to kick things off. So Kid Auto Races is going to open Cinecon. That's the first film that was shot in Venice, California.
So let's take a sidebar.
All right.
You and I...
Yeah.
Went to the location so that we were there on the 100th anniversary of the day that film was shot. We were standing on that spot.
Not only that, you'll recall that lady who came outside
yeah.
from her house and said, what are you doing? And we told her, and as it turns out, she is a part of a committee that's trying to save the buildings because someone has bought them and wants to tear them down to put up a strip mall. And it was you and me being there that day.
And Carl Thede.
And Carl Thede.
Yep.
and my dog, Keaton.
Yep.
The four of us were there, and they started a petition and used that as ammunition to say, this building is a historic site. This was the building that was in Charlie Chaplin's first film as he appeared in that outfit. So we did a good thing that day.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, with the rare films that we're going to be running that your listeners may not have heard of, but we're also going to be running a 35mm restoration print of Buck Benny Rides Again.
Ah.
So, and again, how do you, oh, no, we're not going to run that.
Sure.
Sometimes we'll run, for instance, you know, we usually pair a film with a celebrity who's going to be honored. One year we ran a film for Elena Verdugo, and I remember when we were talking about what to run, and people were going back and forth, and I said, folks, excuse me, can I just say that I have never seen a 35mm print of House of Frankenstein in my life? And everyone turned around and went, you know, you're right. Neither have I. Well, man, we ran that. That was the most attended movie at CineCon.
Of course it was, sure.
And to ask Elena Verdugo in the interview, I said, I have a question for you that I've always wanted to know, and I bet everyone here has thought it at one point. Since you were on the set, what did Lon Chaney actually look like when he was dressed up as the Wolfman? What color was it? And she was saying, oh, it was bright orange, and he had highlights. It was the first highlights you ever saw. It was a fascinating answer. And that's what it is. It's not just about the movies, which that's a tremendous part, but it's also about the celebrities that have come to see themselves. Do I have time to mention a couple of the
stories? You can have
stories?
Time to do anything, sure.
Lou Ayres came to CineCon, and I bet these are stories you know, Frank, because I know you've been going a long time. But Lou Ayres showed up. We honored Lou Ayres one year. And when we gave him his Career Achievement Award, he broke down. And fighting back more tears, he said, this is the first award I've ever been given for my acting. And I'm grateful.
Oh, wow. My God.
It gets me again. Eddie Albert also broke down when he was given his award. And we had his son, Edward Albert, who none of us knew at the time was dying of cancer himself. He gave his dad his award, and Eddie broke down and said, you know, I don't go out anymore. I don't do things anymore. And it's nice to know that you guys haven't forgotten me.
Wow.
You know.
Yeah.
And then there are funny stories. Like, Ann Rutherford was going to join us at the banquet, but this one particular year we couldn't do it at the hotel. We were going to be doing it in a restaurant that was attached to the hotel, but we had to get Ann Rutherford there because she showed up at the hotel, and, you know, it was a long walk for her, and we didn't know what to do, and quickly we thought, let's get one of those luggage carts. So we put a chair on a luggage cart, and we put Ann Rutherford on a luggage cart. And she was so happy to do this, and she was wheeled by two bellmen all throughout the hotel. And she kept waving her hand like she was in a beauty pageant, the way the beauty pageant. And that's all she did. And young people did not understand. Older people, that's Ann Rutherford. And she was just and they wheeled her in on a bell cart to the banquet to cheers. I mean, that – I wish I had a photograph of that, but we were just in shock that she turned it into a great performance. We also had a wonderful time. I remember when Gene Simmons was honored, and a dear departed friend, Robert Noodleman, who was on our board at CineCon, was doing the interview. And Robert's strong point was not an interview, and Gene Simmons was realizing that. And people had questions from the audience, and Robert couldn't hear them and didn't understand. And Gene just took the microphone and turned into Sally Jesse Raphael and was going throughout as far as she could with the mic board, getting questions from people. And she was just she was marvelous. We've had also we had a wonderful screening of Marty, again a movie we normally wouldn't run.
Sure.
But because the director, Delbert Mann, was there, whom I became good friends with later on, he was there, and so we honored him to run this. And he was in a wheelchair, and while he was still cognizant, you know, time had done what it does. And when we brought him up to do the interview, he was in tears before the interview. Just he was so elated that we reacted to the film the way we did. And he got me emotional, too. And for the first 3 minutes, we're trying to calm him and me down and just saying, okay, let's just explain. We love you. We love this film. We think you are great. You won the Oscar. Let's do this interview now. And everyone loved it. And then, of course, I asked him about Cary Grant. And then he's the first person to ever tell a mean Cary Grant story. So all the tears were over for the audience right now because he told stuff. But I love that we give these celebrities a chance to see themselves on the big screen again. Like, you know, and Jane Withers comes every year, so we try to run a Jane Withers film because she loves seeing herself and the audience loves her. Ann Savage became a volunteer at CineCon, and it was very easy for you to be greeted by Ann Savage when you were coming to CineCon to pay your money, and she'd escort you to a seat. And she just loved what we did. And I think a lot of the celebrities understand it. Sometimes we have celebrities who show up who are bigger names. Last year we had Shirley Jones, who was being nice to show up, and we showed a movie with Pat Boone, the one that she did with Pat Boone. And
April Love.
What a good movie. And I liked the movie, even though we were getting heat from people beforehand.
Yeah. But it was, I'd never seen it in scope, and it was a beautiful print, and they were there, so.
Right, and you'll never see it again.
Yeah.
And yet Pat Boone tells this story of how he didn't kiss her in the movie, and there's been a lot of talk about it over the last 50 years, so he plants a kiss on Shirley for the first time, and it made the news.
Yeah.
It went all over the internet. And then at the banquet, she's up there, and three times during her acceptance speech, she says, "Why was I never told of CineCon? How come I did not know?" And she's like, "I want to be here next year." So celebrities understand that we are not just like the Academy Awards or a high-profile film festival. These are people who really care about the films, the preservation of the films, and we love the people who made the films. And so we have a smaller but very loyal following. And that's why when we run our films, you know, it's a Labor Day festival. It always starts the Thursday before Labor Day and runs for 5 straight days. So this year, Thursday is August 28th, and we go straight through. We have our celebrity banquet on Sunday, August 31st. And we're honoring some terrific people. We're still planning. We have more celebrities that have accepted, so I'm not going to announce
it. Sure.
But we do have our website. It's cinecon.org. And we have our Facebook Friends of CineCon Classic Film Festival. And that's always getting updated. And I'm happy to say that we have a really strong film program. And we have some terrific program notes that are in a book. And you are welcome to read them before the film or not read them.
Or not.
Be surprised. And I know, Frank, you have very graciously given us several entries for that program, and thank you.
And also I want to mention on Saturday, the 30th, Dawn Moore, the daughter of Clayton Moore, and I are doing a 100th birthday celebration for Clayton Moore, and that'll be over in the hotel, which is where all the dealer's rooms are. What's the name of the hotel now?
It's called the, it's the one on Hollywood.
I keep calling it the Renaissance, but yeah, it's not that anymore.
It's the Lowe's Hollywood Hotel.
The Lowe's Hollywood Hotel.
But it's
in the Hollywood Highland Complex.
Right.
And even if you don't go to the films, you can come over, go to the dealer's rooms, and see this program, which is at noon-ish on Saturday the 30th. And we have some more surprise guests that we think we're going to have. Mm-hmm. But we're going to show some clips of Clayton Moore and... that'll be a fun day.
That's going to be a fun program. We also have John Bengston, the man who wrote all those wonderful books. He's not only going to do a presentation in the Egyptian Theater, but immediately following the Egyptian Theater, he's going to do a walking tour right outside the theater. So for those people that are going to go Saturday, bring a bag lunch if you want to follow the tour.
And bring some water because it's hot.
Oh, absolutely.
But Bengston is my hero, and I just am amazed by him. And would have him on the podcast every other week if I was closer to him. So this is a definite program to get to. Because he does amazing things.
And I know you've been a very big proponent of CineCon over the years. You've always written
I love
stuff.
CineCon. I love the fact that it's not... You know, the TCM Festival, which I've never gone to. And I think I'd like to see some of the people and all that stuff. But they show stuff that I've seen a million times. And, you know, if you're coming from out of town, it's a great thing but here in Los Angeles, you know, we are lucky. We get to see a lot of good stuff. But CineCon shows stuff that nobody else shows. And it's stuff that's not available on DVD most of the time. It's stuff that doesn't show up on TV.
And on 35mm
film. On 35mm print. So,
yes.
It's amazing.
There will be moments where something is out of focus during a reel change and that they have to reframe the film. And sometimes someone's going to, you know, I think once last year we had to stop for 2 minutes because the film broke, you know.
It's kind of like going to the movies.
Oh, is that what it's like?
It's kind of like that. So... Well, Stan, we've talked long enough. We'll have you back for round two one of these days.
Well, thank you.
But thank you very much for coming along. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
I've been meaning to have you on the show for 2 years now. So.
And I understand, but there were a lot of other people that took precedence, like the guy who blows bubbles through his nose.
Sure,
and,
many better people.
Yes.
Many, many better people. Many, many, many better
people. Sure.
But when I finally ran out of all of them.
That's good. That's good.
So thanks a lot.
Thanks, buddy.
Hope you enjoyed my talk with Stan Tappel. I sure did. He knows a lot about a lot of things, so we'll have him back one of these days. We'll do more podcasts with Stan. And in the meantime, see Stan and see me and see even more at CineCon this weekend if you're in the Los Angeles area or you can get here. And come on, everybody can get here. They have airplanes. This Saturday, as I mentioned in the podcast, I will mention it again because when we recorded that, I couldn't confirm two of the names who are going to be on our panel, and now I can. On Saturday, this coming Saturday, Labor Day weekend, at noon-ish in the hotel, we'll be doing a 100th birthday tribute to Clayton Moore, the Lone Ranger. It'll be me, it'll be Dawn Moore, Clayton's daughter. It'll be Rob Word, who knew Clayton very well and is an expert on Western movies. And also comedian and radio host Jay Thomas will be here to tell his wonderful Clayton Moore story. He's told it on the David Letterman Show, and it's a funny one, and we are delighted to have him come in person to talk about that one. And I think it's going to be a lot of fun. We'll show some clips. We'll all talk about Clayton. I helped him write his autobiography. I was that masked man. And Dawn knew him pretty well, too, so she might have a word or two to say. So I think you'll have a really good time if you are a Lone Ranger fan, but especially a Clayton Moore fan, because there was a lot more to his career than that, and we will talk about it. In addition, there's all sorts of great movies showing at CineCon. Another program, Woody Wise, our friend, is in a film called The Brotherhood of the Popcorn. It's a documentary about Woody and a group of his friends who have been getting together for decades to watch movies. And it will surprise you. It gets very emotional, and some of the guys have incredibly compelling stories. One especially, which I will not tip off now. I think you will enjoy it. Hope you'll visit the website, thecommentarytrack.com and frankthompson.tv. Support the podcast either financially by hitting a donate button or by ordering Amazon anything using the link through our webpage, thecommentarytrack.com. Or just go on iTunes and leave a nice review and a 5-star rating and spread the word. Tell your friends. That's all I'm asking. Just tell people about it. Make sure that your friends are listening so we can build an audience that we can all be proud of. I'm already proud of my audience. I like my audience. These are a good bunch of people, but too few. A happy few, but too few. So spread the word, won't you? We will probably not have an episode next week because I will be at CineCon all weekend from Thursday to Monday evening and we'll just not have time to edit an episode and get it out to you. So take Labor Day weekend off, will you? Have some fun. Do a barbecue. But most important, come to CineCon and say hello to me there. Say hello to Stan. He'll be busy, but it's good to bug him when he's busy. It's always funny. So we'll see you there, and then we'll see you in a couple of weeks with another great interview. And until then, don't worry. We'll fix it in post.